This is Audible.
Watchers of the Throne, The Emperor's Legion, by Chris Raitt. Read by Gareth Armstrong, John Banks, and Emma Gregory. Chapter 1. Tearon. I have considered it, making an end of it all, of course I have. I looked to the skies, I saw good souls succumb to weakness, and foul souls seize their moment. What of it? We all doubt. I have lived over 200 standard years, too long, I think now. I have buried 2 wives, and seen 7 children enter service and leave me for the void. And still I remain here, old, stubborn, in irritatingly good health despite an atmosphere of toxins, both natural and political. I am alone again now. Strange to say that, surrounded as I am by the quadrillions of the throne world, and yet it is truer now than it has ever been. The faces pass me by. I know all of them. I know their histories and their allegiances. I see the plots they hatch and hear the whispers they make under gilded archways, and I grow numb to it all, for it matters so little. Even now, hard against the end of time, when the death rattle of our species has become audible even to the thick-eared, they still grasp for a little more of the things we have always desired. Coin, power, knowledge, gratification. We are yet animals at heart. Nothing has changed that. Not even he could change us, really, though I think he wanted to once. I like to believe that we must be a disappointment to him. If we are not, then his ambitions for us must have been so very poor, and that strikes at all I believe and hold dear. I am Alexei Lev Tearon, and I was a supremely powerful man. I was not a warrior, nor was I a witch, nor was I a commander of great vessels. My power came only from the Lex Imperialis, a cold source, but an ancient one. Like so many within the bureaucracy that swathes us, I was protected by words written on parchment. It gave me my station and defined it. Without this piece of paper, the meanest hive-ganger could have ended me with impunity. She would have ripped the jewels from my fingers and tried to sell them for weapons, and none would have come to my aid, for this galaxy only recognizes strength. But there are many kinds of strength. I learned this during Schola, when I was as sickly as I am now hale, and the smooth-limbed scions of noble houses sought to crush my spirit with their brutishness. I might have died in that hateful place had I not possessed the one talent that has preserved me ever since. The ability to deflect the ambition of others, to make it swerve, to direct hatred onto a target other than myself, to emerge from the lattice of competing egos intact, and with no one aware of what veils have been cast over their stupid, powerful eyes. No, I was not a witch. I just understood the pull of glory while having little attraction to it. I saw a man or a woman, and I knew what they desired. I knew what to say to them, and I knew where to direct them. If they wished to do me harm, I found them prey more alluring. If they wished to help me, I extracted a suitable price. Thus I weaved my path between the paths of others, evading death while it devoured my rivals until I reached the pinnacle, gazing back on a life of dissemblance and brokered deals. Compromise was my way, and for that I am despised. But that is as it should be. The Emperor has many servants, and we cannot all be power-armored killers, can we? I had many titles. This Imperium adores titles. The governor of the lowliest backwater rock will have 100 names, each more ludicrous than the last. As for myself, only one really mattered. Cancellarius Senatorum Imperialis, Chancellor of the Imperial Council in Low Gothic, Should you be inclined to trace that title back to its origins, you will find the true meaning of the words. I was a doorkeeper. I watched people come and go. I made note of their intent. I had soft words with the ones who carried the weapons. I considered those who might be better suited to more exalted positions, and those who might be better extinguished. Over time, that capability generated a mix of terror and attraction. Many were afraid of what I could do to them. Others speculated wildly on what I might desire, so that they might buy me and make me their creature. I was always amused by both reactions, for I did not act from malice, and I cannot be bought. I was a cipher. Even now I wish for nothing other than that which I already possess, for I possess a very great deal. I served in that station for nearly 80 years. I saw the composition of the High 12 change over that span, as death and rivalry took its toll. Some of those lords were vicious, many of them narcissists. Two were positively psychotic, and I remain convinced that a slim majority were always technically insane. And yet, here's the thing, they were all quite superlative. You doubt this? You wish to believe that the masters of the Imperium are men and women of grasping inadequacy, forever squabbling over their own ambitions? Believe away. You're a fool. There are 12 of them. 12? Consider what that means. More human souls now live than have ever lived. In the absence of the active guidance of he who sits on the throne, may his name be blessed, it is those 12 alone who have guided our ravenously fecund species through 10,000 years of survival, within a universe that most assuredly desires to chew on our collective souls and spit the gristle out. Many lesser mortals might have wished in their idle moments that they too could have risen to the heights and sat on a throne of gold and ordered the Imperium as it ought to have been ordered. But they did not do it, and these ones did. They faced down the demands of the Inquisition, the belligerence of chapter masters, the condescension of mutant novitors, and the injunctions of semi-feral assassins, and held their power intact. They orchestrated every response to every Xenos incursion and patiently calibrated the defenses of the endless war. They withstood insurrections and civil strife, zealotry and madness. Every one of them is a master or mistress of the most strenuous and most acute capability, though they burn out quickly. I have seen it, for the cares of humanity are infinite, and they themselves are most assuredly finite. So mock them, if you will, and tell yourself that they have fattened themselves on the labor of the masses, and that they dwell in glorious ignorance while the galaxy smolders to its inevitable ending. That is idiocy, and it is indulgence. I served them for a good mortal span, judging them quietly even as they gave me their orders, and I tell you that though they had their many flaws, they were and have always been the greatest of us. I never thought it would end. I never thought I would live to see the dawn of a day when the High Lords did not govern the Imperium as the highest arbiters of the Emperor's will. In this, as in so much else, I have lived to see my error. Now, as I contemplate what must come next, I understand the true import of what I witnessed. For the first time since he drew mortal breath, they no longer rule. For the first time since the Emperor was placed on the holy golden throne, the High Lords no longer govern the Imperium that preserves his memory. This is how it happened. I remember the date. I remember the time, and remember the angle of the dying sun through my banqueting chamber's windows. You need not be detained with the figures, for all that has changed. In time, I suspect, we will measure things from a different fulcrum, for they cannot remain as they were. What is important? I do not know any more. My belly was full, as it was so often then. I was dining well from a table set with silver platters. All of it was real. Fruits conveyed from the farthest reaches of the segmentum in cryo-tanks. I felt the tight berries burst in my mouth as I chewed. One of those alone would have bought a hive spire on a lesser world, but we were on Terra, at the top of the pyramid, and barely gave it a thought. Perhaps that offends you. Perhaps you think that we were insensitive to indulge ourselves at a time when so many wanted for the basic necessities of life. I care nothing for your judgment. I care not for piety of any kind, and I do not regret the way we were then. We were sophisticates, swimming in an infinity of resources, and we labored for our luxuries. Above all, do not mistake indulgence for corruption. Their elision is frequent, but not inevitable, whatever some inquisitors might think. I looked down at the table and saw the balance of power arranged at every place setting. The mighty were decked in their heavy gowns of office, weighed down with medallions and caskets. Their flesh was bronzed, or black, or gold, painted with a filigree of fine Martian improvements. They murmured to one another, keeping heads bowed, so the words did not travel beyond the hearing of their present counterpart. They were accompanied by pleasure companions, catamites, courtesans, and confidants, who were arrayed even more spectacularly in jerkins and gowns of silk and ruffs of lace. All skin was flawless, all eyes were bright, all conversation was fluid. I held court, and enjoyed doing so. I saw the Lord Constable of the Synopticon lean in close to the neck of the Mistress Plenary of Catacombs and breathe something intended to be scandalous. She absorbed the information without reaction, which was little surprise, as she knew he was destined for removal in a week's time. She knew that because I had told her. She was the sponsor of the one who would replace him, so I judged it prudent to keep her informed, only asking for the standard level of discretion in return. They were all at the same game, my guests, angling, jostling, manoeuvring, and that gave me no little pleasure, as they were all stepping, to a greater or lesser extent, to the moves I had given them. I took another bite, then reached for a golden goblet of opal wine. My hands were heavy with silver, my arms draped with a cloak of thick velvet. Only as I drew the rim to my lips did I notice the presence hovering at my arm. I had no servitors in my employ. I detest them, and even now will not admit them to my chambers. All my staff were human, normal, trained at the finest scholae, and destined for positions of their own within the Adeptus Terra. This was one of those who had excelled, a student plucked from the scholar Havrath before he had turned 15 standard, now my poison catcher, his blood swimming with antitoxins. "Lord," he whispered softly, lowering his head. I turned to him. "What is it, Galeas?" "Forgive me, the master awaits in your reception chamber." I did not need to ask which one. There were three masters among the 12. The master of the Astronomicon, Leops Frank, who would not have travelled here without warning, for he never went without an entourage of over 100 attendants, and that required planning. While the master of the Administratum, Earth-Thu-Himatalian, would not have deigned to visit me, but would have required me to visit him. Such were the requirements of precedence that he set great store by. That left one, the master of the Adeptus Astrotelepathica, Zlatad Ap Kerapliades. My heart sank. I was enjoying myself. Kerapliades was a bore, a man atrophied by his work and shriveled into a drab kernel of pessimism. If he had come here, it would be due to some dire portent delivered by his ranks of dream-speakers. The portents scried by Kerapliades were always dire, and had been since his first blinded interpreter had been bound to the God-Emperor's holy will. But he was a High Lord. If he was here, then I needed to be with him. I observed rank for all my many sins. Not even my many enemies ever accused me otherwise. "Thank you," I said to Galeas in the closed speech of our household. "Ensure he's comfortable. I will be there presently." I did not move immediately. Others would have observed Galeas leaving, and to follow him too swiftly would have invited speculation. I ate some more. I drank some more. I planted a seed of gossip in the mind of the Abanius Cardinal of the Ophelia Tendency, and exchanged pleasantries with the Major General of the Astromilitarum Segmentum Command. When the time was right, when the ebb and flow of the conversation had taken its own course, I rose from my seat and pulled my robes around me. "You'll have to get along without me for a little while," I said. "Try not to eat everything, or each other, while I'm gone." Then I was out into the corridors, padding along the polished floors of my domain. I was dimly aware of movement in the shadows, my cadres of close protection bodyguards hanging within lasshot range, tracking my every move. After so many years, I barely noticed them, and even had they not been clad in camelioplate, I might have forgotten they were there altogether. My aide-de-camp, Anna Mirza Jek, fell in alongside me, her long gown whispering over the black marble. "What's going on?" I asked, never breaking stride. "He's flanked by his nulls," she said, speaking quickly as she always did. "That makes things difficult. This is a guess. He's worried about Cadia."
"I'm worried about Cadia."
"I don't have much else.
Run a grid search over his senior staff movements."
"Already underway."
"How many of our people do we have in the Scholastia?"
37.
"Make contact with them all, and have reports in my chamber before dawn."
"Already underway."
I reached the doors of my reception chamber, turned to Jack and smiled. "When you're done, have a drink."
"If there's time, Lord," she said, bowing and withdrawing.
The doors opened. My reception chamber was a wonderful place. It ought to have been. I had 80 years to refine it. The objects within it were the most exquisite, the decoration a study in good taste. On occasion, despite all the changes, I still spend time there, enjoying it. The High Lords have their own palaces, and the spires of the Senatorum are the most magnificent in the entire galaxy, but I still prefer the oasis I made there. It acts as the exemplar of a message I wish to send at all times, that we are more than guns and fury. We are an ancient species with subtle tastes. We are intelligent, and we are still here. "My greetings, Master," I said, closing the doors behind me. Kerepliades was standing before a sandstone fireplace. He gave no indication he had any comprehension of how valuable it was. Over 12,000 years old, fashioned in pre-Unity Francia. Literally irreplaceable, but I could not blame him for that. He spent his days in iron-ribbed spires, determining how many thousands of human souls would be fed into the mechanisms of the throne, and how many hundreds would be doled out to lives of unremitting duty as sanctioned imperial psychers. I might have been less than equable had I been in his place.
"Is the chamber secure?" Kerepliades asked.
His long face, a bony white-gray with sunken black eyes, regarded me mournfully. He was nearly 2 meters tall, with high-bunched shoulders and long, slender arms. His robes of office were simple, black, heavy fabric hanging in long swathes. He was flanked, as Jack had warned me, by his 2 nulls, whose psychic dampening aura was palpable even to me. "All my chambers are secure, Master," I said. "You know this."
"I know nothing any more." Kerepliades leaned on a steel staff with an iron eye at its tip. "I took a risk coming here."
He looked at me with rheumy eyes. I had never managed to find out just how much he could see through them. Almost all astropaths are blinded by their creation ritual, and those who retain some visual function are damaged in other ways, so they say. I never liked to speculate too closely on what his eyes must have seen since his own soul-binding. "We speak in confidence," I told him, and that was true. "Anything told to me by one of the Council would never be disclosed to another, unless they wished it to be." Kerepliades limped away from the mantelpiece. There were chairs everywhere, but I knew he wouldn't sit. "It's Cadia," he said, as if that conveyed everything that needed to be said. "Well done, Jack," I thought. For as long as the Imperium had existed, Cadia was ever at the forefront of its deliberations. Over the last 200 years, my lifetime, the High Lords had devoted an ever-increasing amount of time to that one world. Regiments had been thrown into the void to bolster it. Space Marine chapters had been petitioned to reinforce its approaches. Armor rights and strategios had been seconded to augment its walls and its fortresses.
There were other battle zones of import, Armageddon, Badab, in which we were stretched, but in truth none of them mattered besides Cadia. For if that world fell, then the balance of power we had cultivated for 10,000 years would be ended at a stroke. "You have tidings from the sector?" I asked. "None." "Well then," I said, "in the absence of that, you do not understand me." It was then that I first truly noticed the master was not his moribund, desiccated self. I was used to seeing him gloomy. I was not used to seeing him scared. His long grey fingers clutched at his support, and even that did not quell the faint trembling. "We can handle the visions," he said, and he no longer looked at me. I do not think he was looking at anything in the chamber just then. "I do not ask of my alpha-level astropaths to undergo what I would not myself. I witness what they witness. I undergo the same trials." I let him speak. I will be truthful. His manner disturbed me. Cerepliades was not the confessional sort. I wondered if his mind had finally been cracked by the strain put on it. Yet he did not show any signs of mania, just a kind of dread. "Probing that close to the eye has always been perilous," he went on. "But now, nothing. No terror, no screaming visions. A curtain has been drawn across it." I did not know what to say to that. We had been at full-scale war over the Cadian Gate for over 5 years, and during that time we had relied on the Adeptus Astrotelepathica for the vast bulk of our knowledge of how our forces were faring. There had always been interference and ambiguity, and often contradiction, but never silence. In my naivety, I even wondered whether it might be a good thing, that the nightmares unleashed by our enemies there might be finally abating. Then I looked at the master again, and saw immediately that it was not a good thing. "Tell me what you need," I said. "Need?" Cerepliades barked a dry sort of laugh. "I need 1,000 more psykers. Stronger ones, not the dross I get from the black ships now." He blinked. His breathing was shallow. "This is different, Chancellor. I can't read it yet, but my blood tells me true enough. Don't be misled by this calm. It comes before catastrophe." He had told me similar things before. I might have learned to ignore the warnings, if it were not for the horrendous expression on his mournful face. "The 12 must meet," he said, "and dissolution must be enacted." So that was it. Another throw of this old die. Despite myself, my heart sank. The arguments had been scoured over and over for more years than I'd been alive, and there had never been a resolution. "I do not think that will be easy," I said, already determining how such a thing could be done. "Camera Inferior is not scheduled for another 3 months." Cerepliades whirled around, fixing me with his strange, swimming eyes. I felt a brief tremor, just for a moment, a flash of insight into his colossal psychic power. It was not meant as a threat, I think, just a momentary lapse in control, but the effect was still startling, like placing one's hand on static electricity. "You can make it happen," he said. "Possibly so." "Have you spoken of this to any of the others?" I asked. "None," he said. "Then I beg you, do not. Not yet. I will make my approaches. It would be best, coming from me." "I know," he said, and a grim smile cracked his features. "You have wormed your way into the confidence of us all, doorkeeper. Sometimes I think you are the most dangerous man on Terra." Perhaps he meant that to be flattering. "You give me too much credit," I said. "I merely accommodate."
"So you say." The hollow look in his eyes returned. "Do it, though. Do what has to be done. If you need coin, if you need anything, let me know."
That was an amusing thought. I had more coin than any of them knew. I could have bought half the council with it already, were any of them remotely interested in such things. But to their credit, none of them were. If they had vices, then they were all connected to power, not avarice, and baubles held little sway over such souls. "Of course, there is one difference this time," I ventured cautiously, knowing that I was telling Cerepliades something he already knew. The Lord Brack has not yet been replaced, and so one seat is empty.
Yes, and you know now what must be done, do you not?
I do not choose the High Lords, I said.
Go to see him,
he said. I do not think he will receive me, I said.
You will find a way, he said.
And that was it. That was why he had come, to plant this idea in my head, to give it his blessing. I judged from this that he had support from others of the 12. He would not have advanced it if not. He was bound by the Lex Imperialis from making overt approaches himself, as were all his peers in the council. But that would never stop them from making their views known. It put me in a delicate position. Half the council had always been against dissolution, half for it. A reconfiguration might not change that, and by intervening now, I risked aligning myself with a losing cause. A dangerous thing, even for a man like me. I would need time to confer with Jack, and plot a route through this. The tides of intrigue in the palace could rise fast and fall fast. The trick was not to be carried by them. I bowed. I'm honored that you came, master, I said. Cerapliades did not return the bow.
I'll be waiting, he said, limping towards the chamber's doors.
His nulls went with him, making my flesh crawl as they passed me. Once he was gone, I waited a while, pondering what to make of the visit. His fear had not been feigned. I still found it unsettling to witness fear from a High Lord, and that alone weighed more heavily on me than anything he had said. After a suitable interval, Jack reappeared, looking curious.
Anything of importance? She asked.
Not sure yet, I said. I was aware I had guests waiting. I placed my hands on Jack's to thank her for her concern, but could not linger to consult her then. That would have to wait for a few hours, by which point I might have settled the issues more clearly in my own mind. I went back towards the dining chamber, gradually resuming my appearance of joviality as I walked. By the time I re-entered, my face was full of smiles again.
"What kept you?"
asked the woman sitting on my left, just as the final courses were being delivered.
"Great matters of state?"
"A little indigestion," I said, reaching for the sorbet. "Not that there's much difference."
Chapter 2. Valerian. We were never soldiers. Whenever we are seen outside the walls of this place, as rare as that is, it is in our martial aspect. We are clad in gold, just as we were in the earliest days, when he was our living captain, and mortals fall on their faces as if before gods. To them, it must seem as if we are wrath incarnate. To them, it must seem as if we were created for destruction and nothing else. But we were his companions once. We were the ones in whom he confided. We were his counselors. We were his artisans. We were the first glimpse at what the species could become if shepherded aright and unshackled from its vicious weaknesses. Of course, we were taught to fight. He knew that war would come. It was a necessary part of the ascension, though it was never destined to last for eternity. We were the guardians of a new age, and had to be strong enough to keep it secure. We failed in that, and now wear the mark of that failure in the black robes that cover our Auramite. It is a permanent reminder, replacing the cloaks of blood red that once adorned our battle plate. It weighs heavy with every one of us, for we know more of the nature of the fall than most. We still recite the old stories, and we study in the lost archives where we alone are suffered to tread, and so do not have the comforting illusions of ignorance to salve the wound. In a galaxy defined by ignorance, we remember. We cultivate the shards of the thing that was broken, and remain aware of what would have been. I think sometimes that this knowledge is the most severe of our many burdens. Any brutal soul may fight if he has the goal ahead of him. We fight knowing that our truest purpose lies behind us, and all that remains is faithfulness to an extinguished vision. But still, we preserve. We tend the things of value that have survived. We seek to embody His will in all things. We cleave to His light as the darkness gathers. We interpret, we study, we delve into the philosophy of the ages. We have many duties, but that is just as it should be, for we are not simple creations. The eons have changed us in many ways, but not in that. We were 1,000 things to 1,000 souls, but we were never soldiers. I am Valerian, shield captain of the Paleologian chamber of the Hykanotoi. Like all my brothers, I have many other names, carved in a long trail, one after the other, along the inside of my breastplate. Some names were earned in combat, many more were earned after contemplation of the mysteries. We cleave to this old practice, though I do not know for certain if we observe the rituals correctly. So much has been lost as the millennia unwind, and most significant of all is certainty. In our theology, we talk of the speculum certus and the speculum obscurus. The first of these is the study of what is already known. If this strikes you as pointless, allow me to respectfully demur, for it is one thing to know what the emperor said, and quite another to know what he meant. He left no written testimony. The entirety of what we know of him is revealed either through the records of remembrances or the ecstatic visions gifted to the faithful. And thus, when a thing is placed in the canon of the certus, the intention behind it can never be fixed with surety. There are arguments, nearly 10,000 years old, concerning single utterances committed to parchment 100 years after he spoke last from mortal lips. There are savants in the Tower of Hegemon who have devoted their entire lives to the interpretation of such fragments, and we do not scorn them, for their study is the study of fate's weft itself. Even now, it is possible to gain enlightenment through meditation on the words of those who lived then. But if the matter of the certus provokes debate, then that is nothing to the controversy of the obscurus, for the emperor left much unsaid that he would doubtless have made clear in time. There were things he would have wished us to know, had there only been the opportunity to place it on record. We look out from our spires at the realm of mankind as it exists now, and we can only speculate what his intention is towards it. This is the study of the emperor's will, revealed in dreams and the patient scrutiny of arcane logic. If such matters bore or baffle you, then forgive me, for they are the objects of my very existence. I am named Philologus by my brothers, the scholar. If I did not have my many other duties, I could imagine a life immersed in the minutiae of such philosophy. That may appear as indulgent and a waste of the gifts given to me, but such would be to misunderstand the precipice on which we teeter. Without him, we are lost. Everything is lost. Our only salvation is through the interpretation of his will, and as a consequence of our failure, we must divine this much as a blind man might divine the pattern of marks on an unseen page. And in any case, I have never had the luxury of an indulgent life. For a long time now, the walls we guard have been crumbling. Enemies assail us from every quarter, striking even at the heart of the most heavily guarded citadel in the Imperium of Man, forcing us to become what we were never intended to be, pure vengeance, pure defiance. In that time I took up my spear and found a different artistry there, but those were not the first battles we fought. They took place within the walls, and were conducted with our own kind amid the very palace where he yet dwelt, dormant in his deathless vigil. I did not know it then, back before the skies were cleaved and the foundations of all creation were rocked, but it began at that moment with the arrival of a mortal man to the halls of the undying. He was overweight, with a wry face and sparse curls of age-whitened hair. He carried himself poorly, almost apologetically, as if he were somehow surprised to be instantiated at all. His dress, however, was far from modest, a thick robe of purple overlaid with a chasuble of gold. He bore icons of the High Council, the double-headed Aquila surmounted by the skull within halo. I knew his name, but had never met him in person before. That was not especially unusual. Even the senior staff of the Administratum ran into many tens of thousands, though this one was more influential than most. Out of long habit, virtually unconsciously, I reached a judgment on the fastest method of killing him. I found the optimal results, less than a microsecond of effort required, slightly amusing. "Chancellor Tyron," I said. I did not bow. There are some who see this absence of traditional courtesy as arrogance, but in truth, we only bow to the master of mankind, for to do otherwise would be the most profound disrespect. I attempted to be non-threatening, however, and extended my hand to usher him into my private chambers.
"Shield, Captain,"
Tyron said, bowing conventionally and going inside. I was not wearing armor, only the simple black robes of my order. Even so, I was over a third taller than Tyron, and far more heavily built. My rooms were no doubt sparser than he was used to, being undressed stone and solely candlelit. The only relief from the austere lines came from my piles of hidebound books, some surrounded by glittering stasis fields to preserve the fragile contents.
"I am grateful for this audience," the man said,
settling into the chair I had selected for him. I took my place opposite. I would have preferred to stand, but did what I could to make things less awkward for him. "There is nothing to be grateful for," I said. "The Chancellor of the Senatorum Imperialis is welcome here at any time. Your burdens must be heavy." He smiled a dry smile.
"Nothing in comparison to yours," he said. "I'll not detain you longer than necessary. I request an audience with the Captain General. I'm aware it's difficult, but I'm acting on behalf of the Council. It's been hard to know who to approach, as I was informed that both tribunes are indisposed. So I'll say it again. I'm grateful for you making the time."
Tyron was correct. Both tribunes were indisposed. Heraclion was performing ritual duties in his capacity as Master of the Heteron Guard, the companions of the Emperor, and he would not have responded to a summons from anyone. Italio, his counterpart, was engaged in holy warfare and was similarly impossible to reach for all but the most vital of causes. The Chancellor, I had been told by my amanuensis beforehand, had been prepared for the first circumstance, but not the latter. Yes, the custodians fight. Yes, we have been doing so for millennia. How else could it be that our fellowship remains prepared? Only the nature and the parameters of our warfare were at issue in those days of transition, not the essential matter of it. "The Captain General is aware of the situation within the Council," I said.
"It's a delicate stage," Tyron said. "Understand me. I don't act on behalf of any faction, but I'm beholden when any of them ask me."
"Understood."
"But you're aware of the debates?"
"Perfectly."
"And that matters in the war are reaching a critical juncture?"
"I suspect that no one in the entire Imperium knew that better than us. The Captain General stated his opposition to taking a seat on the Senatorum Imperialis 15 years ago," I said. "His views have not changed."
"But the seat must be filled,"
Tyron said, quietly. He was an effective performer. I have seen men and women enter into blind panic when confronted with one of our kind. The Chancellor was afraid. That was natural. But he was neither foolish enough to hide it, nor craven enough to let it master him. He clearly knew what the settled position of the Adeptus Custodes was, yet must also have known that our master had come close to accepting the honor following the death of Speaker Iulia Lestia of the Ordo Malleus 15 years ago. Now that Chancellor Brach was gone too, another chance presented itself. "Is there unanimity in favor?" I asked. The question was superfluous. We knew the positions of all 11 remaining High Lords, but I was interested to hear Tyrion's response.
"I've served the Council for 80 years, he said. "I've never known it be unanimous about anything."
He leaned forwards in his seat, cupping his hands.
"When dissolution was last proposed, the vote was split evenly, 6 for each motion, and thus no action was taken. I can't help but think that matters have become more desperate since then. The proposal here is simple, Shield Captain, to place the question into your hands.
That is, if all the lords cast their vote just as they did before."
"A safe assumption."
"Nothing in this galaxy is safe, though, is it?
Hence the need to consider this."
I smiled. I liked this man. There had been a time when I despised mortals. In the early years of my service, when my physical perfection had been achieved, but I knew little of the deeper truths of the universe, I saw them as irritants, impediments, ever apt to stray into corruption or futility. It was Navradaran of the Ephoroi who changed my mind. He has spent more time outside the confines of the palace than most of us, and his counsel had a great effect on me. In these darker days, I see humans as essentially children, which is not intended to belittle them. They have the potential to be so much more, but we, their guardians, will never lead them into that future if we concentrate exclusively on their inescapable failings. All fail, even the greatest of us. We, perhaps above all, ought to remember that.
"You are troubled by Cadia," I said. He nodded earnestly.
"Nothing troubles me more. I read the dispatches. I have nightmares. Real nightmares, ones that keep me from getting the sleep I need. That's the background to all this. That's what's changing."
"It is one world."
"It's the gate."
"One of many," he shrugged.
"You'll know more of that than me, but I'll tell you truly, the High Lords have never been as anxious. They think we'll lose it."
"Tell me this, then. What difference would dissolution make?"
"I don't know. I'm not a member of the Council. My only task here is to set the options before those who'll decide."
I regarded him carefully. As we had been speaking, I had been making my assessment. He was clever, that much was certain. That cleverness was damaged by a degree of ebullience, which may well have been overcompensation from some deeper-seated sense of doubt.
"The Imperium, as it exists, rewards the strong and the savage. This Tyrion was clearly neither, and so had been forced to develop other strategies for survival. I could not blame him for that. My masters would want to know if he could be trusted, though. My initial feeling was that he could. It is hard to deceive us, even for the most subtle of souls, and I doubted Tyrion would bother to try."
"We are not part of your Imperium," I said. "We involve ourselves within it only if we deem his will demands it. Do you really think, Chancellor, that your proposed audience with the Captain General could have any influence on his final judgment?" This was the question. This was where he lost or won it. I waited for the reply with some interest, and was pleased to see that he did not hesitate.
"Not to be impious," he said, looking me in the eye, "but yes, it most certainly could."
"You are confident?"
"I'm aware of the stakes."
"You think we are not?"
"Just 5 minutes with him," Tyrion said seriously. "Then we'll see."
Chapter 3. Alaea. In a time when so much was lost, we were found. It truly amazes me now, thinking back, knowing more than I did, that the Imperium's grasp on us had been let slip so completely. We held within our hands the kernel of salvation, and we were forgotten. To be sure, we had always served here and there. They still had to garrison their black ships, and there were inquisitors who understood our value. But in essence, they had let us wither. I explained this to Valerian a long time later when I was still angry. He did his best to understand that. But I could not help contrast the life he had enjoyed, cloistered in his halls of gold, immersed in the finest and the oldest things of a fading empire, when we were in the emptiness, scratching for survival as horrific tides lapped at our ankles. It was all so stupid. That's the great danger that condemns us, not demon blades, but dumb ignorance. We've become a stupid race, glorying in the easy goals of anger and piety. Then again, I'm aware my perspective is unusual. You see reality differently, lacking a soul. It's a harder place, I think. Its edges are sharper. There are no gods in my world. The things other people see, I do not. Even he is not a god to us, though saying that out loud would soon see me in a jail and on the racks. Not that I'd ever say it out loud. Not that I'd ever say anything out loud. I don't talk much these days. I called myself a witch-seeker long before the rank became established again. That was what we did, hunting the soul weak from the long shadows. It was like an instinct. That was all we had, for Throne knows we had little else. Our chamber was 9 strong. 7 of us had taken the vow, 2 more were undergoing trials. In the ancient past it was said that the vow was taken in the presence of the Emperor, but that was obviously impossible for us. We could not even reliably get to Terra, let alone negotiate an audience with the guardians of the throne. We observed the old rites as best we could, convening in our drafty old tower on Eresa with our chipped armor and blunted swords. None of us knew when we spoke the words if we did so correctly, but we maintained the faith, and the binding effect was as strong for us as it had been for our sisters in generations past. The last audible words to pass my lips were, "I so vow it." Actually, that's not true. At the time, though, I certainly believed it to be. After that, it was all gesture and nuance and thought mark. I preferred it. The clarity I have always sought came more easily when not distracted by the twitter of pointless, fleeting utterances. If I had to make one change, one single change that might restore something like spine to this decaying Imperium, it would be this. Say less, do more. A battle sign gesture is the thing itself, the first movement of the sword thrust or the trigger pull, not the spoken command, which is a different act. So much talk, so little action. Now that I've seen Terra itself, I've seen how bad it can truly be. There are humans who spend their entire lives drowning in words written and spoken, bleeding their limited existence out over pointless verbal jockeying. And they say we have no souls. My name is Tanau Alea. I am of the Anathema Sykana, what used to be called a Null Maiden, or, even stupider, a Sister of Silence. Who came up with those titles? Not one of our order, that's for sure. Probably a High Lord. They're mostly idiots. We didn't have organized ranks back then. I served under the one who had kept things together for a long time, a woman whose memory I revere. I still hope to meet her again, for I don't think she can possibly be dead. It would have taken a whole tide of the Shedim to keep her down, and they'd be shrieking the whole time while she pulled them apart. Her name was Sister Atarine Hestia, and she was the one who found us all, back when Terra had all but forgotten we existed, pulled us up, beat some sense into our hive trash heads, and made us warriors. I think it must have been like that on 100 worlds, sometimes with official blessing, sometimes under active persecution, but always there, gathering in the dark, doing what we had been made to do. Who made us like this? I don't know. I don't think he did. I think we were always waiting, playing different parts, waiting for our time to come again. We'll all have our versions of when it started. For me, it was out in the void, running silent, closing in on the benighted staging post of Hellion Quintus, where I had reason to believe there was a woman who had sold her soul to damnation for a brief escape from the hell of living. I was right about that. I was just wrong about everything else. I entered the Hellion orbital zone on a single-person Kull-class interceptor. In those days, we rarely used fully crewed subwarp vessels. Even highly trained carders of human normals found it hard to work with us, so in many cases we opted for servitor-equipped ships. Those thought-dead drones were still capable of twitching when I walked past them. Somewhere deep in what remained of their limbic function, a vestigial horror of me still squatted, which was annoying. You could slice half their brains open, tie their nerves into loops, and still they could barely remain in the same chamber as us. It would be worse in the staging post, but I might be able to get in and out without attracting much attention. Hellion was one of those throwback stations, built sometime in the very distant past, when traders would still attempt to make warp jumps without properly sanctioned navigators, then find themselves stuck in scream space and having to abort rapidly. The vagaries of warp conduits being what they were, the station grew up around what old-time captains used to call a bale shaft, a safe well in real space, squatting at the base of a whole cluster of capillary exits. For a time, so our intelligence told us, the place had done well, even attracting some military spending from the sub-prefect's resilience commander to beef up its guns. The usual hangers-on turned up. Permanent traders, thieves, missionaries, pleasure-bringers. They said it was quite the place back then, if rough around the edges. Not now. No one flew a warp hull now without a whole team of navigators to guide it. Even contemplating making a jump without many days' preparation and the Geller fields at full integrity was madness. The ether was like boiling oil, and rumour said more ships were being lost now than were being built. That was bad news for Hellion, and all the other half-cocked stations spinning within the old bale shafts. Hardly anything dared to make the passage. The bulkers stopped coming, as did the navy tenders. The only ships that plied such routes now were the ones that had a reason to stay hidden, and that diminished the quality of Hellion's occupants further. Respectable people drifted away, leaving whole sections of its spiral structure echoing and empty. So there we had it, a half-deserted void station full of contraband runners and slavers operating off the major warp routes as the Empyrean fizzed madly all around it. You didn't need to be a seer to guess that it was a weak link, a place where mortal fallibility would find plenty of hooks to get entangled with. That wasn't all, of course. We had our methods, our informers, our hunches. We'd seen a pattern of events develop over the past few decades. Cells of Shedim worshippers had grown more numerous, and we couldn't burn them fast enough, especially considering the need to remain out of sight of the jumpier units of the Adeptus Arbites. Hestia herself had immolated a secret society called the Circlet, locked deep down under the shipyards orbiting Irenan V. Before they had all died, we got some garbled information that led us to other associated beds of heresy, among them Hellion Quintus. So here I was, clad in my old armour, my charred flamer in my hand, watching the dark twist of metal turning slowly in the abyss. I let the servitors handle the comm traffic for docking, which involved them shunting binaric response codes to similarly lobotomized creatures at the other end. We came in low, under a heavy supporting beam for one of the station's big spokes. I finalized suiting up and opened the airlock doors into a place that stank of human urine. There was no one waiting for me, not even automated guard units. The corridor's lumens strobed uncomfortably on low power levels. I activated my Helm's cartographic scanner and isolated the chamber I needed. There was a direct route through the lower strata, avoiding the station's populated zones, which made my task a little easier. I went quickly, hugging the plentiful shadows. Most of the living things I encountered were servitor-grade, blind and limping creatures of metal and pulled flesh that ignored me. A few human normals lingered in those wells of darkness, and as soon as they laid eyes on me, they looked even more nauseous than they had before hurrying away. I caught sight of flashes of grey in the dark, and filmy eyes, and emaciated hands clutching at ragged cloak ends. Humanity, I thought to myself. Master of the stars. Soon one of those wretches would get a message up to what passed for the authorities in that place, alerting them to the strangely armoured interloper skulking along in the gloom. But by that point, I planned to be long gone. I reached my destination, a locked door set amid a whole row of locked doors. The plasteel was pitted and spotted with rust, and in the centre of the panel was a small armour-glass slide viewer. I might have chosen to depress the summon chime and wait for someone to pull the viewer's shielding back, but long experience had taught me that my unique repulsiveness could be detected even through a solid mass, so I seized the mechanism with my gauntlet, activated a freeze grip, and shattered it. Then I was through, kicking the door aside and scanning beyond it. I detected movement from 6 warm bodies within, 2 up close, 4 more further off. Lasfire crisscrossed out of the gloom, aimed immediately and accurately. I ducked under the worst of it, letting my armour deal with the rest. The hot stench of scorched oramite filled my nostrils as I opened up with my flamer. I caught the 2 closest in that inferno, and soon heard the counterpoint of their screams. A Lasgun's power unit blew, showering the confined space with a burst of static, but by then I was already pushing through the shimmering flame curtains to the ones beyond. They fired back, and I perceived outlines of armoured bodies trembling in the heat shake. Nothing they possessed could harm me. My presence alone was enough to make their flesh rebel, and I could smell panic in their gestures. I used my flames like a flail, pulling them round and melting their crude armour plates. Even as they were dying, I learned something of them. They were better equipped and better armed than the cult members I had expected, which was good, as it indicated we'd found a higher breed of degenerate. I glimpsed snatches of bare flesh as their armour crisped away, pale and deceased, before it too was consumed. They did not run, despite their fear. Never let it be said that hatred had blinded me entirely to quality. I could appreciate a foe who stood their ground. Soon, though, only one remained, the woman I had come for, backing away from me. She was portly, swathed in a layer of fat that was probably synthetic and designed for endurance during void transit. She was wearing the slack uniform of a maintenance supervisor, marked with pale grey runes of relevant expertise, but she was no maintenance supervisor. Even one of the ungifted, even one of the very stupidest of our species, ought to have been able to spot it, the wrongness hanging over her like foul flatus. There was no visual cues, just a certain manner, a certain bearing, and it shrieked out moral squalor. I let the flamer gutter out. She looked at me, her eyes half-steady, holding a lasgun two-handed. She had dark hair, matted with greasy sweat. She grinned at me twitchily. I could see she was terrified. Perhaps she knew better than most what I lacked that I should have possessed. "They told us you'd be a danger," she said. I don't know what she expected me to do then. Talk to her? I wasn't even remotely tempted. Talking, like most things, is a skill built on repetition. After a while, you lose even the motivation to practice. I looked around the chamber. Documents were spread out across dark iron tables, among them data slates and secure comm canisters. On one of the walls was a great chart, made of what looked like animal hides, only part burned away by my flamer. It contained symbolic representations of planetary systems, connected by a skein of warp routes etched in a dark brown fluid. "Too late, anyway," she said, tracking me with her weapon, a standard-grade item that had no chance of troubling my armor. "Doesn't matter now. It's all ending, and very soon." I found her certainty intriguing. Most invective from cultists was bluster, designed to bolster their own courage more than anything else. This was different. She almost sounded sorry about it. I looked back at her, and she recoiled. Her lip curled back. She took a step away almost before she'd realized it. "Let me tell you something. You never get used to it. You never lose the wounds. You grow up your whole life surrounded by people who loathe you for a reason they can't even articulate, and it gets stuck under your skin. The training helps, of course. We learn techniques. We have old mantras to recite, telling ourselves that we are, in reality, the greatest of his servants, which is less about boastfulness than self-preservation. But you never really believe it, and every flinch, every appalled expression, twists like the old knife a little bit." "I won't tell you anything," she said defiantly. What a strange notion. She thought I was there to question her. I opened the flamer up again, dousing her in a column of heart's blood fire. For a moment I watched her writhe and jerk within the hot purification, her body a black clot against the screen of unleashed energy. "So look at me now," I thought, allowing myself a sliver of savage pleasure at the spectacle of this woman's just and warranted suffering. I let the execution go on too long. I used up too much sacred fuel, which was a sin Hestia would not find easy to forgive. By the time I was done, her body was a steaming heap of embers, laced with the last boiling remnants of her blood and elements. I shut off my flamer's Promethean line. I took a long breath. I let the heavy clouds of heat dissipate. Then I went over to the chart. Unsurprisingly, the material was not animal hide, but something fouler. More surprisingly, it was a coherent representation of warp space, such as might be used by a navigator or an imperial general. I was no scholar of the Empyrean, but I could understand a great deal of what it